SBS live streams and podcasts are supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water. Yirra Damarung, hello, I'm your host Luana Grant and welcome to NITV Radio for this Friday, the 21st of June. Coming up on today's show, NITV Radio chats to artist Jara Carolina Steele, curator for the First Peoples Melbourne Art Trams as part of the Rising Festival for 2024. There are six trams that have rolled out across the Melbourne Tram Network featuring the work of First Nations artists. The first tram to hit the Melbourne city streets was led by Indigenous artist Dr. Destiny Deacon, who passed away in May. Jara chats to NITV Radio about her inspiration for her art and the curation process for the Rising Festival. And we share a few top stories from our NITV news team. All these stories coming up after NITV Radio's news wrap of the week.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
They've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
Indigenous deaths in custody will continue to be a blight on society if the corrective service system remains underfunded, an inquest has found. A coronial inquiry into the death in custody of a Wobbegal man, Michael Baker, has concluded he died alone in his cell at Lithgow Correctional Centre in the New South Wales Central Tablelands of cardiac arrhythmia. But the coroner says the understaffing of prison doctors and nurses meant the care he received fell well short of an appropriate level. He says Mr. Baker was not seen by a doctor following a short stint in hospital in the months leading up to his death. The federal and Queensland governments say they are committed to the World Heritage process for Cape York, which has been nominated for inclusion on UNESCO's list. The process to join the World Heritage list can take up to 5 years. But Queensland Premier Stephen Miles says this nomination has already been years in the making. He says they are prepared to do the work required to complete the listing alongside traditional owner groups and the Cape York community.
This is a process that we've been on for about 10 years now. I worked on this when I was the Environment Minister, and it's very special to have reached this next milestone. I want to personally thank the First Nations leaders who've worked with us on this nomination, who've come with us on this journey. This is about supporting them to protect their lands, protect their cultures.
Queensland sites already on the World Heritage List include the Great Barrier Reef, Gari, and the wet tropics in the state's northeast. A new Indigenous language program has taken flight with the Northern Territory Medical Service. The program is contained in a series of videos created by Indigenous designers Echo Whiskey, which explain patients' rights and expectations in 9 different Indigenous languages, as well as detailing how to provide feedback and complaints. CareFlight hopes they will foster better communication between First Nations patients and English-speaking staff. They estimate about 90% of its patients in rural Northern Territory are Indigenous. Residents say they are concerned about the multi-million redevelopment of a housing block that has historically provided affordable housing for Aboriginal residents in Sydney's inner city. A group of residents say they can no longer afford to live there after the construction of a $140 million multi-storey student accommodation tower to be known as the Pemulwuy Project. New affordable housing in the area, known as the Block, was to be funded by leasing out for 99 years. But CEO of the Metropolitan Local Aboriginal Land Council, Nathan Morin, has told NITV and Living Black that less than 20% of the current tenants are originally from the Block.
I think it's about a philosophical change from the housing company being founded to provide Aboriginal community housing to the realities of the housing services it provides today are more or less mainstream. I'd like to commend our community for forcing the housing company to have a component for Aboriginal students and acknowledge that it was actually the Redfern Aboriginal community who were calling for a percentage of that tenancy to be Aboriginal. In fact, openly saying why couldn't it be 100% Aboriginal student accommodation is an issue for us.
A new book outlines new details of mass killings of Aboriginal people by European settlers from 1824 until the 1980s in what became known as the Frontier Wars. For more than 20 years, as part of a truth-telling project, a team at the University of Newcastle, led by the late Professor Lyndall Ryan, has been mapping the prevalence and scale of the killings, what has become known as the Frontier Massacres. Dr. Robin Smith at Charles Darwin University says her new book adds to that work by revealing not only the perpetrators of massacres, but also their enablers, both public and private. Dr. Smith says her work shows police were not the principal perpetrators and other settlers were involved in the killings. The First Nations Awabakal community in the New South Wales Hunter region is celebrating the protection of a sacred women's cave. After 13 years of campaigning to have the Butterfly Cave saved from development, the state government has now purchased the land to turn it into a national park. Traditionally, women have been taking girls to the cave to teach history, culture and weaving. In the past, they had to seek permission to walk on the track to the cave, but now Awabakal women can go to the sacred site whenever they want. Auntie Lynn Brown, an Aboriginal role model in the community, says hearing that the site has been saved was an incredible feeling.
The announcement of saving the cave, saving the site around it was amazing. It was like our hearts were broken and they just mended it. Excitement, crying, happiness, we finally done it. It took us a long time. We continued to fight and fight and fight till we, you know, got what we needed for our community and our Aboriginal people.
New South Wales Minister for Heritage and the Environment, Penny Sharp, told SBS News the victory was hard won.
This is a tribute to the tenacity of the women who've, you know, built a campaign for over 10 years and refused to take no for an answer. But I also want to acknowledge that the developers come to the party and been willing to allow the government to purchase the land and to hand it over to the National Parks and Wildlife Service.
Australia's federal court has awarded native title rights to the Kabi Kabi people, whose traditional land covers a large portion of the Sunshine Coast in southern Queensland. The landmark decision comes after the legal claim was first lodged in 2013 and recognises more than 360,000 hectares of land and water as belonging to the traditional owners. The area includes Noosa, Maroochydore and Bribie Island. In making her decision, Justice Bernard Collier says she's satisfied the Kabi Kabi people have always had rights and interest in the country and should be able to take resources from the area for any purpose. The rights are non-exclusive, meaning they coexist with federal and state laws. Chief Executive of the Queensland South Native Title Services, Tim Wishart, says it's been a long journey for those involved.
It's really tough for Indigenous Australians to have to prove who they are, why they are, and the fact that they've maintained their culture to get this sort of outcome. It's really quite an unfairness of the system.
Record spending on social housing has been included in an otherwise tight New South Wales budget, but advocates say years of investment will be needed to address the urgent need. The budget includes the largest social housing investment in New South Wales state history, with the pledge to fund 8,400 social homes. 6,200 of them will be new and the rest knocked down rebuilds. Mark Degatardi is the CEO of Community Housing Industry Association. He says the state government should be commended for taking some steps to address the housing problem, but more action will be needed.
We're seeing demand for social housing right now at about 58,000 households across New South Wales. 9,000 of those are on the priority waiting list, so they're people at imminent risk of homelessness. So you can see the crisis is huge. We have to take those first steps, and it's important to commend government for making that investment because it means we can start to get going. But we also need to look at land use, government land in particular, and also look at underutilised social housing assets.
The New South Wales government has defended its decision to introduce a payroll tax rebate for GPs at bulk billing clinics, as well as a waiver for past unpaid tax liabilities. Once the rebate is legislated, it will be given an ongoing rebate for contracted GP wages for clinics with bulk billing rates above 80% in metropolitan Sydney and above 70% in the rest of the state. Doctors have said the previous payroll tax would have made clinics unviable and forced GPs to charge patients around $20 extra per visit. Health Minister Ryan Park says they have heard the concerns of the medical community and are also confident that the measure will reduce the strain on the state's busy hospital system.
What we know in New South Wales right now is this: the pressure on our emergency departments has never been as great as it is now. The last quarter, we saw over 800,000 patients present to our emergency departments. What we cannot afford to see is any further reductions in bulk billing, and as a result, leaving people with no opportunity other than to attend their local emergency department. That's not sustainable.
New South Wales Health has estimated that a 1% decrease in bulk billing equates to around 3,000 additional emergency presentations. Victoria will become the first Australian state to raise the age of criminal responsibility to 12. Premier Jacinta Allen and Youth Justice Minister Enver Erdogan introduced the long-awaited Youth Justice Bill, which would lift the age from 10 to the state parliament on Tuesday. Ms. Allen told reporters children under 12 should not be treated as criminals.
This is legislation that will reduce youth offending, it will increase community safety, but also, too importantly, it will provide an opportunity for young people to turn their lives around, because 10 and 11-year-olds don't belong in the criminal justice system. Simply, they belong in schools and in places where they're getting support.
Children as young as 10 can be charged, convicted and imprisoned in every Australian state and territory except the Northern Territory. The NT raised the age of criminal responsibility to 12 in August, while the ACT passed legislation to raise the age to 14 by 2025, with some exceptions. The parliamentary inquiry has heard from women with lived experience of perimenopause and menopause on the need for better education and service provision. The inquiry has been hearing views from health groups, politicians and the business sector on whether there should be a legislation mandating paid leave to cover such conditions. The CEO of Menopause Friendly Australia, Grace Malloy, earlier told the inquiry menopause symptoms are driving women to early retirement. Imogen Crump is a former journalist with the BBC and ABC and now editor of a news site with the University of Melbourne. She says it took her 5 years to get a diagnosis and there needs to be better education and service provision.
It was only when the night sweats and hot flushes kicked in that my GP said the word, "Oh, perimenopause." And that was almost 5 years after my original symptoms presented themselves. But 5 years is 1,825 days. 1,300 of those were working days. It could and should be so much more straightforward.
A $14 million sculpture by Brisbane artist Lindy Lee has finally arrived at the National Gallery of Australia. It has taken almost a week to transport from Queensland, where Lee has been working on it for the past 4 years, to mark the 40th anniversary of the National Gallery of Australia. The price tag makes it the single biggest ever investment in an artwork by the gallery. Nick Mitsovich, the gallery's director, says the hope is the installation, designed to last at least 500 years, will become a icon when it is viewable by the public from October. Ms. Lee says the work is designed to be timeless.
The work's called the Ouroboros. The word is actually means the snake that swallows its own tail. So it's constantly eating its own tail. So it's a symbol of birth and death. and constant beginnings and constant renewals. I grew up during a time when Australia was still going through the White Australia policies. You know, I'm a little bit scarred by that, being a Chinese person. So the work I want to make needs to be inclusive and respect and treasure all people.
The Indigenous Literacy Foundation is celebrating the delivery of 500,000 books by Australia Post. The milestone book was posted from Sydney to the town of Cunnamulla in Queensland Southwest. The Indigenous Literacy Foundation provides books to First Nations children to encourage reading, with many written in language. The 500,000th book to be sent out by Australia Post is called Molly Bin Git Stack, or Molly Gets Stuck. Written in Creole and English, the story is about a pig that gets trapped under a van on a hot day. The CEO of the Australia Post Group, Paul Graham, says it's an important moment to pause and reflect on what has been achieved.
Well, ALF is one of our core partners, and literacy, and particularly literacy for children, is really important to Australia Post. We are connected to every single community, so we can reach out to those communities using our fantastic distribution channel to distribute things like books, which are so critical to particularly kids and young kids, not only learning how to read, but also learning about their own culture.
And that is NITV Radio's News Wrap of the Week.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio. Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Luana Grant, and you're listening to NITV Radio. Still to come on the show, NITV Radio chats to artist Jarrah Steele, curator for the First Peoples Melbourne Art Trams as part of the Rising Festival for 2024. But first, here are a few top stories this week from our NITV news team. Remote communities in far north Queensland will get a reprieve from skyrocketing costs of living expenses with a 20% discount on groceries. It comes after the state's premier announced a major boost to a freight subsidy scheme in the region as part of a big spending pre-election budget.
The cost of living in remote communities is often 3 to 4 times higher than other areas. Essential items like fresh vegetables, bread and milk will now be cheaper after the Queensland government lifted its freight subsidy in the far north from 5 to 20%.
20% is a huge increase for those communities, and it is going to make a lot of difference. Everywhere I've travelled, I've heard of the challenges of keeping up with everyday essential items, and I know this is going to support families, it is going to support businesses, and I'm just so proud to represent a government that is listening to Queenslanders.
But customers won't see discounts just yet. Negotiations are still underway with 32 suppliers to implement the changes, which should come into effect next month.
This is designed to address the excessive cost of groceries, particularly fresh food. It's expected that this additional subsidy will decrease the cost of a bottle of milk from $5.40 to $4.32. This is a very direct contribution to address the escalating cost of buying food in remote parts of our state.
But the discounts won't flow to the Bowser. The cost of fuel is excluded. Soft drinks, clothing, furniture, and white goods are also out, along with alcohol and tobacco. The announcement greeted with cautious optimism.
I think the government just maybe one of their ploys, I'm not sure. They could be saying that, look, we're going to put another subsidy there, and whether it happens in the near future, whatnot, it's always a wait and see. And maybe they are chasing boats or trying to win some people over now, you know, to stay in government.
The discount scheme will cost $64 million and will run for 18 months ahead of a review. Facing an election in October, Queensland Labor has splashed $11 billion on cost of living relief measures in its recent budget.
This is all about addressing what Queenslanders have said to me, which is their number one concern right now is how much it costs to pay for the basics. And we want to support these remote communities so that they can put fresh food on the table for their families.
Cheaper groceries to shore up political support. Dan Rennie, NITV News.
A new book on colonial expansion into Australia's north is shining a light on frontier violence and those behind it. It's called License to Kill, Massacre Men of Australia's North, and it uncovers new truths behind some of the darkest parts of the nation's history. Our Northern Territory correspondent Emma Kellaway has this report.
A truth behind one of Australia's most revered novels turned film.
The magic of the Never Never.
Written by Jeannie Gunn and published in 1908, We of the Never Never was a story of early colonisation at Elsie Station on the Roper River in the Northern Territory.
When her book was added to the Australian curriculum to go into schools, there was a chapter of her book that was expunged. And that chapter was about a massacre on the Elsie River.
It's one of many truths detailed in a new book launched this week at Charles Darwin University, the product of years of research on massacre sites across Australia's north.
Well, I hope that it contributes to some of the truth-telling and truth-listening that is going on around the country at the moment.
To date, more than 400 massacre sites have been identified. The new book looks to reveal perpetrators and benefactors behind those, many whose memory lives on as a sore reminder in place names across the region.
These people are revered in our history. Without what I like to refer to as the dirty bits being properly recorded.
Some of those figures have had the highest civic honour of having whole suburbs named after them. I think it's critically important for truth-telling, because if you don't know the story, then it just becomes a part that you feel like it's missing.
Finding truth in a painful past. Emma Kellaway, NITV News.
It was an ambitious plan to breathe new life into Sydney's inner-city First Nations community of Redfern. Built on the famous block, the Pemulwuy Project promised to create a residential, commercial and cultural precinct. Now the $140 million development is complete. Some Redfern residents say they can't afford to live there and are questioning its benefits to the community.
Pemulwuy grew out of the rubble of the block after decades of controversy, a project driven by housing company CEO Mick Mundine.
Of course I'm proud of what we achieved, not just what I achieved.
It's a development that wouldn't have happened without the support of Sydney's Lord Mayor, Clover Moore.
I really admire the achievement.
But it's not for everyone. Ali Golding, a long-time resident of the block, was invited back but says it's too expensive.
I don't think elders can afford to live back on the block, and I wouldn't be able to.
Not only elders, Ali Golding's daughter wanted to move in, but said the rents were too high.
Those higher levels actually help offset the social and the lower end of the middle range of the affordable, so we can actually create more of those social houses.
The Aboriginal Housing Company says it never gave a commitment to rehouse people from the block in the new development. According to Nathan Moran, CEO of the local Aboriginal Land Council, very few have returned.
Less than 20% of the current tenants were originally from the block.
Nathan Moran claims that two women, former block residents who wanted accommodation in the new development, did not have their applications considered because they were too old.
Despite being younger than some of the tenants of the housing company on the block today,
neither the Aboriginal Housing Company chairperson nor the CEO can recall this incident. The financial viability of the Pemulwuy project relied on leasing out for 99 years a student accommodation tower on freehold land given to the housing company by the City of Sydney Council. 110 of the 520 beds in the building are made available to Indigenous students at a cheaper rate.
Last year we had six, and I believe this year to date we've got 10 in there now.
Why couldn't it be 100% Aboriginal student accommodation is an issue for us.
Carla Grant, NITV News.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Recently, a new fleet of trams that features the artwork of First Nations artists has rolled out across Melbourne Tram Network as part of the Rising Festival for 2024. NITV Radio recently caught up with First Nations artist Jara Steele, curator for the First Peoples Melbourne Art Trams, to chat about the curation process and the various artists that have been selected to feature. The first tram to hit the Melbourne city streets was led by Indigenous artist Dr. Destiny Deacon, who passed away in May. Jara chats to NITV Radio about her inspiration for her art and the curation process for the Rising Festival, as well as the impact Dr. Deacon has had within the art space.
My name is Jara Carolina Steele. I'm a Boonwurrung, Wemba Wemba and Tooloway woman, and I am a multidisciplinary artist and curator for the Rising Melbourne Art Trams. That's me.
And we will get into the Rising Festival 2024 a little bit later in the interview, but I just wanted to start off, if you could just explain your art. I did read that you put in your bio, your art is an expression of memory, culture and identity. Do you mind expanding on that and where you draw your inspiration from creating art?
Yeah, sure. So it's funny, sometimes I struggle explaining my work because it's so layered on all the things. But a lot of it comes from just like growing up in community, in culture and country with my, you know, my mum's Maui, Carolyn Briggs. So I had a very strong sense of my identity at a very young age. And also, like, you know, growing up around people like Prida and Marie Clark, who were reviving a lot of our visual designs and identities at the time. You know, Nola Kerr, who was working on kangaroo skins that led to the possum skin revival that a lot of people don't know about, and many more amazing trailblazers that at the time I didn't know they were. They were just my uncles and aunties and cousins. And I draw on that a lot. I grew up in the inner suburbs of Melbourne, Brunswick, Carlton, North Melbourne, and even in the city itself. So a lot of my work is connected to that kind of, you know, living as a contemporary human in an urban environment. I also draw on to pop culture and signage, because, like, I see it everywhere. It's part of my everyday life. So there's just a lot of levels and layers to my work, but it all connects to really just myself in a way, and the family, and just trying to find a way to express that through visuals, because sometimes I can't fully articulate it very well. I hope it gets through to people, but even if it doesn't, I hope they just enjoy some art sometimes. It's just like nice to put things that are interesting out in the world.
Yeah, definitely. And what materials and mediums do you like to use when you are creating art?
I've done it all. So I actually, I started out doing fashion design originally years and years ago. I got into RMIT fashion, but as the university industry complex can be, it was not a safe place for me to be. Eventually I got into costume design and then set design, and then went into my master's of fine art, and then moved to public art. So I have like a lot to draw from. I've done film photography. I do a lot of digital art. I work in, you know, on Adobe Software Suites, and I make video games and augmented reality art.
That's really interesting.
Thank you. I also like do like big public art installations. I have four permanent public art works in Melbourne CBD that are LED in language.
Oh, wow. That's really, really awesome. And where are those located in the city in Melbourne?
There's one in, so I have my wall at Murup in Stevenson's Lane. That's not the permanent one, but that was a part of the whole project. And then there's one in Goldie Place, just off Russell. That says you are on country. Another one in White Hart Lane. I want to say that I'm pretty sure it's that. And in language, and I can't say it, unfortunately, my tongue gets tied very easily, but it says, be here with love and respect in language, which was from a song that I wrote with James Henry. And another work that says, message chick, in language. And finally, it hasn't launched officially yet, because it has to be lit, and there was, like, you know, issues as always with public art. Hopefully in the next half of the year, and it says Wurrung, and that will be, I think it's Flinders Lane, just off Queen.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Next, we continue our interview with First Nations artist Jarrah Steele, curator for the Rising Festival 2024 First Peoples Melbourne Art Trams. And recently, you were involved in curating art on the Melbourne trams as part of Rising Festival 2024 that you mentioned a bit earlier. And that's dedicated to showcasing art from First Peoples artists in Victoria. Can you talk to us a bit about that and how you got involved?
Yeah, so I actually, you know, and I forgot to mention this, I had a art tram during Kimberley Moulton, a Yoda Yoda curator who's amazing, back in 2021. And it launched just before the May lockdowns here in Melbourne. And it was a big pink tram with a ilk, which is our word for a short fin eel, which came from the stories that my mum would tell me about the journey cycles of the eel. And when Kimberley was leaving, there was the call out for a new curator. And I debated and I told myself I wouldn't get it. And last second, I was like, just do it. Or you'll regret it. So I submitted, I gave them a bunch of ideas, one of them being reviving Lynn Onus's 1991 tram and putting it in a modern way, and all the other ideas that I had on the top of my head. And they loved it. So they invited me in. I started November 2021 and went straight in, put the EOI out for Unapologetically Black, which was the first theme. We got about 65 applications or close to at that point, and I had my first six artists, and they were all Victorian mob, which was really special and important to me as well, because we don't usually get seen on our own country and our own streets. The next year we had Black Futurism, because a lot of my work kind of connects to that Indigenous Futurism that came originally from North America and the First Nations groups there. Yeah, I put it out there, and the majority of the works are all digital, except for Peter Wopple's Crow, which was this beautiful collage texture piece that was multi-medium, beautiful work, and a lot of young people from different areas around Australia, but all living and working in Victoria. And then this year, I didn't have a theme, but I had a secret motive, which was to honour the trailblazers of the Indigenous urban art movement of the 80s and 90s, which I grew up around. So I know the movement probably started a lot sooner than that, but this was kind of the people that I grew up with. So my first thing was I wanted Aunty Ellen Jose's art to be on a tram. Aunty Ellen passed away in, I want to say 2017. Apologies if it was later. I can't remember at the top of my head right now. And I also wanted to honour Destiny, because every time I use BLAK, I always acknowledged her for coining it, because it is something that's really important to me. And she is, you know, she was someone who changed culture and language that we all use today, and that's who it came from. So we got Ellen, Jose Foundation, to agree to put a work on a tram. We got it from the Australian War Memorial in Canberra, and I worked closely with Destiny on selecting the work and making it very easy for her because I said, you don't need to lift a finger. We're going to do this for you. And it was really amazing to work with her. And then I selected artists that I could tell came from that legacy, even if they weren't aware of it, of those kind of legacy artists like Destiny, Lynn Onus, Arnie Ellen Jose, and many, many more who, you know, a lot of the who aren't with us today. So I could see elements of each of these artists who applied, and we got 103 applications.
Still a lot of applications.
It is, and especially for a project like this, because, you know, a lot of us mob, we feel shame, we don't apply, you know, and I, you know, the last few years we've been pushing and it's been getting out to regional communities, and, you know, I get on to my aunts and my uncles and my even my mum, I go, come on, spruik it out, tell everyone to apply. And we got there, and I had a very large short list. But these, you know, four artists that, you know, there's a mix of established and very, very young emerging artists, and which is always something that's always important to me as well, is including an elder. But they really spoke to that energy and art scene of that time that I really believe is not known by even our own community. It's not educated in schools. We learn more about the European masters than our own homegrown artists who not only were, you know, making incredible art, but they were activists. They changed culture. They helped move us forward. And all of the contemporary First Nations artists doing work today have them to thank. And we are on the shoulders of them. And it was really important for me to connect those amazing other artists who I equally want to celebrate, because I know Destiny would not want to take up space from them. It neither would Ellen. Yeah, just I somehow hit the jackpot because especially some of these artists applied multiple times. Kate James applied. Kate, Aluka and Tom both applied three times for the art trams, and this was the year for it. And if they didn't keep trying and you know, developing the work, paying attention to what an art tram is meant to be, because a lot of these works that get submitted aren't feasible, you know, I'm so glad that they kept pushing and applying. I'm very, very grateful for that.
And how long will these trams be showcased on the Melbourne tram lines for people to see?
So thankfully, the Rising Melbourne Art Trams runs for a whole year. Whatever happens next with the program, they will be on the tracks until June next year, which is very exciting.
Finally, what's next for you in your career?
There's a lot of things that I'm working on at the moment. Probably the most closest that's going to be out, I'm doing the visuals for Dan Sultan's MSO show at Hamer Hall, which will be during NAIDOC week on the 12th and the 13th. I think the 12th is sold out, but the 13th isn't. And I'm going to try and apply for my PhD, and I have an interview next week, and a million other little projects that I can't officially talk about right now, but I'm not stopping right now, unfortunately, but it's enough to keep going, I think. I come from survivors and people who keep pushing through, and I'm I love art so much, and I love what I do that I can't stop. So, yeah. But I really appreciate talking to you today and sharing this with Melbourne community, because this is why I do it. It's for us. You know, and everyone else gets to enjoy it afterwards. So thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on. You're very busy, so I appreciate you taking the time to chat to me. And hopefully everyone can get down to Melbourne, or if anyone's living in Melbourne, and check out these beautiful, the beautiful artworks on the trams and all the amazing work that you and the other artists have been doing.
Yeah, thank you. And please celebrate them as well, because we don't get projects like this unless it's really like in the eye of everybody in the public, and we celebrate the artists. You don't even have to tag me. to celebrate these artists because they're incredible and it's been a joy to work with all of them.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
You're listening to the radio of NITV.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
And that's all we have time for on today's program. You can listen back to the show anytime online or catch any of our stories on our website at sbs.com.au. NITV Radio will be back on Monday with more stories from right across the country. I'm your host, Luana Grant Mundungor. Thanks so much for listening and have a great day.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.